Today, we're in the West, Eastern Washington State, in the country of the Grand Coulee, to be specific. We'll talk with author Bruce Holbert on his lovely and riveting The Hour of Lead. Holbert's books reveal the harshness and loneliness, the grit and cruelty of surviving in the Northwest. Though The Hour of Lead reveals the heart and yearning that bring people together, it is tough and graphic at times. Ultimately, his writing is so arresting that you're drawn into the characters and the beautiful, challenging territory of Eastern Washington State. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. I spoke with Bruce Holbert when his gritty Western noir, Lonesome Animals, was released. I had mixed feelings about that book, but not about his writing, and I was anxious to read his latest book, The Hour of Lead, which is also set in the harsh environment of Eastern Washington and spans the entire 20th century. It's a strange sort of coming of age for its main character, Matt Lawson, whose twin brother and father die in the opening pages during a biting snowstorm. These events define his character, and he spends the novel learning to be human. Holbert's life is as interesting as his characters. His grandfather was murdered by his own father-in-law, and Holbert himself was involved in the accidental shooting of a friend. He lives in a dramatic part of the West, and it all comes out in his finely honed prose. Here's my conversation with Bruce Holbert. Thanks, Bruce. I've been anxious to talk to you about this book.
I'm pleased to have the opportunity.
This is The Hour of Lead, remembered if outlived, as freezing persons recollect the snow. First, chill, then stupor, then the letting go. And that is how you open part one of The Hour of Lead. And it's a quote from Emily Dickinson from her poem 372. So let's talk first. I'd like to talk about Emily Dickinson with you because she has a presence in this book and maybe was a partner with you and in it, or maybe you're having a conversation with her. I don't know. Can we talk a little bit about Emily Dickinson?
Sure, sure. She does sort of evolve into a presence for me in the book. At first, you know, I didn't realize that I would be, you know, part of what I would be writing about was considering her work and the sort of isolation that goes along with her reputation. And slowly as I was writing, I was discovering different places where she kind of, met me halfway.
And you refer either by name or sometimes just in the musings of one of your characters, you refer to her work. And it struck me also that this book in many ways is depicting life and emotion in the same kind of way she does, with a sense of sometimes harshness and horror, sometimes dripping love. And I think that your book personifies those things as well.
Well, I'm flattered. Anything that I come close to personifying that has to do with Emily Dickinson has to be a good thing.
The book opens up with a snowstorm that sets all the subsequent events of the story in motion, and the characters seem driven by the feelings and yearnings that they have, but these external events that they experienced really define their trajectory. And can you talk a little bit about that opening chapter where the characters are so sweetly defined and then meet some devastation?
Yeah, the book originally, I started working on the book when I was in graduate school. One of my instructors there, Alan Gerganis, had, because he knew I liked to write about places, suggested that I write three short stories, one taking place at a separate time, but each place is the same. So the idea is the three stories take place in the same place, but the time is different enough that the place has changed. And I began working on the first one, and it's the only instance I can remember of this happening, but after the first, second, or third, you know, sentence, I had some idea of what was going to happen around page 200. And so it just sort of jumped out at me. And it didn't, not necessarily the shape, but the sort of emotional arc. And it started with that snowstorm. I had recently read a collection of stories called Nebraska by Ron Hansen. And there was a snowstorm in one of those stories, and it really had haunted me. And it was more of a historical accounting, and I wanted mine to be more personal. So I sort of employed that tool of you know, the arbitrary and sudden sort of threat of weather. And that's something that people in those circumstances still had to deal with. That's one of the things that's different now, is that it's less of a threat, although if you look at the fires around my country, you know, you can see the threat's still there. So I guess that's really where it came from. And then the idea that both of the twins were boys in the beginning are smitten with their teacher, and the idea that, you know, one would end up dying and the other would end up sort of through a process of trying to stay alive having sex with her. To me, that just started all the sort of strangeness. Everything sort of unraveled from there, and that the characters kind of come apart. Some of them come together again in the end, some of them don't, or some of them come together and they're, you know, contorted. But what I really wanted was some sort of force to propel these characters into their own sort of strange world.
And it is a strange world, and I have to say that I was a little nervous approaching the book, Bruce. Lonesome Animals, your previous book, I found I needed a little courage to approach it in that it... It depicted a harsh life. It was a rough Western, I thought. I think
it's a very violent book.
Yes, it was a very violent book, and The Hour of Lead. The moment I started it, I felt drawn in to their world, and there were some strange aspects of it, and there were some graphic aspects of it, but I felt that the characters, like many of us, are like all of us, perhaps, are defined by their loss, and that was established right there in the first chapter. And in fact, the teacher that Matt has sex with before his time. I think that was something he said, that before he should have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was suffering from a loss and a yearning. And the trajectory of her storyline was interesting and unusual as well.
Yeah, she suffers probably worse than most of the rest of the characters after that. I mean, her suffering is kind of a slow descent into insanity.
Later in the story, she has a son, and he has an interesting trajectory as well. There's a feral quality to them and to some of the characters and the way you talk about them. And I find it interesting that you talk about animals a lot in the book, too, and describing cold as animals experience it really makes it indelible for the reader.
Yeah, I think part of the experience of you know the West during that time period and being in the West in general is a kind of isolation, and I think isolation does encourage us to respond to sort of our primitive elements of our nature, and that you know we need to be sort of socialized just like as children. You know, we need to, you know, you go to school, and a big part of the reason you go to school is to be socialized, is to deal with other children. Well, Matt and Wendy and Lucky and Linda don't have that opportunity because at an early age they're sort of blocked off from that. They see themselves as strange, so strange that kind of socializing is impossible. And so they're really locked into themselves. You know, the moments that they become unlocked are, you know, powerful for them, but also filled with the potential for tragedy because, you know, they don't have any experience with that, and B, you know, emotion is dangerous. It hurts.
And Matt was maybe overly sensitive to what he perceived as rejection and the overpowering nature of his love, that he didn't understand that even. And then to feel this sense of rejection really threw him into a self-inflicted kind of isolation, that even when he was surrounded by others and being highly productive, he still was a man unto himself with a real hair-trigger temper, too.
Yeah, and actually his temper doesn't have a hair trigger. It's just, I think he says that the problem is that everything makes him angry, and that when he acts on his anger is when he gets full. But that means he tolerates some things when he's not full that he wouldn't tolerate, you know, 2 hours later. So I think it's less that it's less the hair trigger than I think it's the conscious sort of awareness that you don't fit and that things are going on around you that you're not permitted to participate in. And these things are really, you know, primal and necessary things. And for some reason you don't have access to those things, and so they make you mad. And he acts sometimes on, you know, the smallest thing because he's endured small things and big things up to that point, if that makes any sense.
I think he, as a character, sometimes I felt was hard to penetrate because he himself didn't have the skills of self-examination or whatever.
I think he is somewhat hard to penetrate, and I think that's the point of him, or the reason he's constructed the way he is. My dad grew up without a father. His father was murdered by his grandfather. And he, not that he's a whole lot like Matt, but to some extent, manhood and fatherhood for him was a hair shirt. He was a wonderful father and is a fine man, but there was a level of discomfort with it, a level of doubt, a level of, am I doing this right, that sometimes caused him to respond not to his kids or his family, but to the discomfort. And I really didn't understand that until I had kids, that sometimes you're responding to your own doubts when you respond to your kids and your own fears. And I think because he didn't have a model to grow up with, he didn't have get to watch somebody father him, that there was a part of who he was that's, you know, was impenetrable and took a long time. I don't think he's impenetrable anymore, but I can see now that his lack of access to himself is part of the reason why the rest of us had a hard time accessing him.
Did your experience with your father feed right into your characterization of Matt Lawson?
I would say that my interest in sort of primitive mythology, the idea of, the idea of having a course that's set for you by your tribe, and that there are places, you know, rites of passage, and there are also little things that lead you to that rite of passage. The fact that I think part of it is that I feel like my, intellectually more than emotionally, I felt like my dad didn't have those rites of passage in front of him. And so he had to guess at them. So I think that idea of not having a model to follow is something that I took from his situation. He and Matt are not a whole lot alike, except for they're both kind of stoic. But that element is something I took from him.
And Matt also had warm instincts that he was clumsy with. And I think we have to mention that this is a love story too.
Yeah.
You know, and his instincts towards Wendy were so sweet and thoughtful, yet, and in other places in the story too, there was a sensitivity, but it's almost like he didn't know what to do with that all the time,
or was easily
thwarted.
And that's again because he didn't have, he didn't have the pattern to follow. He didn't have, he didn't get to watch his father with his mother, for very long. And so as a result, he was awkward. He had these feelings, and he had never seen them played out before him. And so when he had them, he didn't have a template to put them in. My wife mentioned this the other day. My oldest son, Luke, is very close with his girlfriend, and he's in college. And my wife said, he treats her just like you treat me. And in this case, she was saying that's a good thing. But, it kind of struck me that I'd provided a model. I didn't even know I was. He's following that model because he thinks it works. Well, Matt didn't have any models to follow.
Well, I hope your wife thinks it works, too. It sounds like she
seems to. She's still kill my wife. So,
well, that's maybe a nice segue into. There are some interesting women characters in the book, and they are challenged and challenging and strong and headstrong. And I mean, Wendy, who is the object of Matt Lawson's affections, and the teacher. And Mrs. Lawson, for a while, and we should mention that this story starts out, I think, in 1918, and in some ways is an epic over many, what, six?
Yeah, it ends in 1978.
Yeah, and carries these characters through their lives. Mm-hmm. But when Matt feels rejected by Wendy, he goes off and he is away for many years as he is, I don't know if I want to use the term finding himself, but he's doing some other work. And
he's a little like an animal. And in fact, his mother says that he's an animal. When he gets hurt, he's going to go hide, you know, and he's probably not going to come back because he doesn't, you know, because that's what animals do.
She had an interesting understanding of her son and he of her. She admitted to herself that maybe the wrong son died and that she maybe didn't mother this son the way she mothered her other son. And she was hurt and wounded by the loss of her husband. And at one point, she goes off and lives her own life. And he understands that, of why she needed to do that. But for a while, after Matt leaves, Wendy moves in with Mrs. Lawson. Mm-hmm. And they form a life together. And could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, what ended up happening, and I didn't realize it was happening until it happened, was that part of the book, you have several women together. Trying to forge a life, and then you have several men together trying to forge a life on the Jarms Ranch. And what came out, I think, was a sort of multiplication of personalities. I mean, I think that what happened was that the men, because there were no women there, ended up quietly demonstrating some gentleness that we would, you know, typically associate with women. And the women, on the other hand, because there were no men there to take up the typical role, quietly demonstrated some real strength and toughness and bravery that, you know, stereotypically we would associate with the male role. So for me, that was really one of the most interesting things that happened in the book. I'm pleased that you liked the female characters, because to me they were the most interesting characters in the book. They were the ones who when I was writing, they would be the ones that would spark new things.
And I loved when they would warm themselves up with a little moonshine.
Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, and again, they're not trapped by the type by the gender types. You know, they're you know, I can eat the top of the cake if I want to. Damn it!
Right, right.
I like the frosting. I don't like the other.
Yeah, and I thought Linda, the school teacher, was just intriguing in her. In her trajectory and her path in life, and you come back to her in the end, or near the end of the book, and I was glad of that. I somehow wanted to know what happened with her.
Yeah, she was such a significant character that, that you know, Lucky had to go back to her at some point. And she's part of what's interesting to me, and, you know, you talk about the Emily Dickinson connection, I think that maybe in her character is where it's one of the strongest, is she's sort of slowly getting farther and farther away from what makes sense, what's real, what, you know, what we would expect a mother to do, and how parents treat their children. She's getting farther and farther away from that. But there's a part of her that's sort of observing that and recognizing it, that it's strange and that it's probably not healthy, but also recognizing that it's what she wants to do, you know, that this is what she has built and this is what she wanted, even though it's not the way it's supposed to be.
In her own way, she represents a sort of independence. That's what I thought all the women characters represented, this independence, even in how she conceives Lucky. And mm-hmm. and our readers will have to find out a lot of the details of this book, because the story is really unfolding. And I really have to say that the pacing of the book kind of brings you in, folds you in, and then there's just even the way you have the chapters of kind of going back and forth between some of the characters. There's a building momentum that that I enjoyed as a reader.
I'm glad that that momentum works, because it, as a writer, I had never done that before. I had never written from multiple points of view, and I enjoyed it, and, you know, I've enjoyed it in other books, but it's you know, it's one of those things that you, just because other people have managed the trick, you don't know if you can.
I'm talking today with Bruce Hulbert about his book, The Hour of Lead. I'll continue talking with him in just a minute. Let's take a break with John Gorka, Don't Judge a Life, from his album, The Bright Side of Down. Stay with us.
Don't judge a life by the way it ends. Losing the light as night descends. For we are here and then we're gone. Remnants to reel and carry on. Endings are rare where all is well. Yes, and the tale easy to tell. Stories of lives drawn simplified, as if the facts were cut and dried. Don't judge a life as if you knew, like you were there and saw it through. Measure a life by what was best, when they were better than the rest. Reserve your wrath for those who judge, those quick to point and hold a grudge. Take them to task who only lead, while others pay, while others bleed. Tapping the keys in a life of rhyme, ending the tune and standard time. Silence fills the afternoon. A long, long way gone too soon. Don't judge a life by the way it ends, losing the light as night descends. A chance to love is what we've got, for we are here and then.
That was John Gorka with Don't Judge a Life from his 2014 album, The Bright Side of Down. I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. Let's return to Bruce Hulbert. We're talking about his book, The Hour of Lead.
I want to talk to you a little bit about this book and your previous book are set in Eastern Washington and at a cuspy time in history where things mm-hmm. were changing. And the landscape is so much part of the characterizations in the book. And you do, in these two books, I'd say, manifest some of those archetypal Western qualities, but also it opens up the reader to those regional realities. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. I mean, I think first and foremost that in this country, anything not set in Manhattan is regional.
Uh-huh.
That New York dominates the literary landscape and the conversation to such an extent, as far as what gets read and what gets reviewed, that there is a tendency to sort of forget that the rest of the country exists. And I do understand the sort of bitterness that somebody might come to concerning being considered a regional writer, because there's an idea that that's some sort of a limitation, and that somebody from New York writing about the architecture or the subways, that person isn't a regional writer, even though I never rode a subway until I went to New York and never have since. There's a kind of bitterness about that from writers outside of there, and I think it's earned. I think that oftentimes we're dismissed, and what I think is really a problem is that the lives of our people are dismissed, and it tends to not just cheapen our literature, but cheapen the people who live outside of New York, who have different sensibilities. I think that particular regions do provide particular experiences. There's no better example than Faulkner. Faulkner's greatest work had to be about the South, and it had to be about the conditions there, the lost cause. And that informed everything that he did, and it's what made it great. It's what that sort of gothic, tragic sort of element in it is what made it wonderful. And I live in the West, so I have to employ the things that inform my experience and the experience of my characters, which are sometimes typically Western. You know, the isolation, violence. For instance, in Lonesome Animals, we were talking about before, yeah, there's a lot of violence, and the violence is very graphic, but I had to be really graphic because the culture has taught us that violence is heroic, and that and I didn't want the particular character who was doing most of the violence to be heroic at all. In fact, that was a big part of what I was, you know, working on was how broken he was. And as a result, I had to write a book that was maybe even more violent than I intended, just so people outside of the region could see it as it was, as opposed to, you know, just another cartoon.
And from a reader's perspective, I think that we read to experience other realities, other realities than our own.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us do live outside of New York. So I think that it's an interesting position that there is a New York establishment that defines a lot of maybe what we might call mainstream writing and publication. Yet most of us readers are probably more open to other experiences that aren't mm-hmm. our own. So, and I'm wondering if you're working on anything, or if you want to talk about anything. I know sometimes.
I'm always working on several things. I've got my kids are out of the house now, but I sort of wrote while my kids were growing up, and with my wife, and I made a decision right after graduate school that I didn't want to go on the adjunct university merry-go-round because I didn't want, you know, we were going to start a family and I didn't want to be dragging my family all over the place. And so I went back to teaching high school and, you know, raising my kids and coaching them and going to their games or going to their concerts and stuff like that. And so I always worked on several things at once and sort of cobbled time together. And I still seem to be functioning that way. Right now I'm working on I've got a novel with my agent and also several short stories with her. I'm also working on a pilot for a TV series for Lonesome Animals the producer, Stephen Garrett, he bought the options, and he's been kind of coaching me through the screenplay process. And then I'm working on a semi-memoir and another new novel. So I'm kind of hopping back and forth.
Well, we'll look forward to that. And I hope that sometime you'll come visit us when you're down in Northern California.
I would love to.
Yeah, I think it'd be great. I think it'd be great.
I've got a lot of friends down there, and it's a beautiful country. And I will take you up on that.
Okay. Thanks so much. We've been talking with Bruce Holbert, The Hour of Lead. Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the chance to talk to you.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
I've been speaking with Bruce Holbert from his home in eastern Washington State, the country of the Grand Coulee. His latest book is The Hour of Lead, and I hope you'll pick it up and give it a read. I also spoke with Bruce a few years ago when his first novel was released, Lonesome Animals. I thought it might be interesting to hear that conversation, too.
Lonesome Animals is a story, a Western. It is a mystery, but it is also a story of place, of storytelling, dealing with issues of life and death. I think it's a book for courageous readers. So I'd like to start first talking with you about the whole setting of the book, which is in Washington State, in a rugged part of the state, and in a time period that spans many years, but the bulk of the story happens during the period of time when the Grand Coulee Dam was being built. And I think this is a part of the country that you maybe grew up in. So tell us a little bit about that space and that time.
Well, I did grow up in that part of the country. I have lived here in different sorts of parts of the state for most of my life. I think I chose that time period because it was a time period when the West, the old mythical West, was still sort of present enough to collide with the new West, the West of controlling water and constructing dams and huge projects that weren't likely to occur in the West before that period. And I guess I'm interested in that collision. I'm interested in the Western myth and how it's dysfunctional in some ways. And a big part of the reason why it's dysfunctional is that it doesn't, it instructs people how to live in a different time period. And so choosing an instance where things were changing so quickly, the idea that a river like the Columbia River could be stopped up helped me sort of ground me as I was writing it in that, it made that change and that conflict just kind of constant.
And it seems that there were passages in the book where it went down to affecting really the lives and livelihood of people working the land. And
yeah, absolutely. It affects how people view themselves. You tell yourself a story about who you are and how to be a man or how to be a woman, and all of a sudden the world changes so quickly that your story begins to have holes in it. It begins to not work so well. I think Strahl early on in the novel says that he's a mean guard dog with nothing to guard anymore because the place has settled down.
I'm glad you brought that up, and Russell Strahl is the main character in the book. He served as a lawman at one point in time, and then after a passage of so many years, he's called back into duty. I don't know if it's that same quote or if it was later on when he said something about being a mean dog waiting for another dog, or something like that. And when I looked for that quote, I couldn't find it again, so I hope I didn't make it up. But
I think it's early on in the book, and I think I think maybe there were a couple of sentences related to that idea of being a mean dog with nothing to guard. And what happens is the dog doesn't quit being mean.
Right. And yes. And Strahl is an interesting character. And I looked at him as somebody who either didn't have a soul or was searching for his soul. I don't know how else to put it or characterize it. And again, it's some pretty tough experiences he has, he goes through, he commits, and very much dealing with life and death issues and issues of, or this is how I'm characterizing it, of humanity even, and what makes us human, and what is it to end a life. And I couldn't help feel that through some of these episodes, some of which are fairly grisly. And I know in your own life you have had that experience of that was characterized in a piece you had recently or a couple of months ago in the New York Times, that you yourself had the experience of accidentally shooting somebody and killing them. And I wondered if how that informed your portrayal of Strahl and his experiences.
Well, I suppose a big part of my conception of this book was my great-grandfather, whose last name was Strahl, but it's spelled differently. My great-grandfather murdered my grandfather. They were in an argument over land or something. My grandfather and my grandmother had come back to his ranch to help him out. He was getting older, and they had a disagreement about land, which isn't uncommon on ranches and farms like that. But it was always, you know, it always was one of the kind of family secrets of my family. I would ask my grandmother, where's Grandpa? And, all I knew was that he was dead. But the way people answered that question, even as a child, I knew there was more to it than that. And so as I got older, I pieced together more and more pieces. And then finally my dad told me more about it after my grandmother died. I think he felt like when my grandmother was alive that he was kind of honoring her wishes by not talking about it much. So I suppose that I was interested in, because I know that the death I was involved in was a tremendous influence on how I viewed the world and the rest of my life. It really was an awful event to have been involved in and instigated. And I guess part of me was trying to figure out how my great-grandfather could have killed someone with intent and not feel or face the horror that I felt like I faced. So I was really kind of poking around trying to figure out how somebody gets to that point. And I suppose if I compare it to my own sort of experience, it would be like the opposite. It would be like how did he manage to kill his son-in-law on purpose, when me accidentally shooting a friend tore me up as much as it did. So I suppose that's the influence that it had on my life. The other influence is obviously the sort of tradition of violence in the West that has interested me in a number of different levels for a long time.
And the whole collision as well of the Native American culture and the whites.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me that the Western myth and the Western experience has been one of self-annihilation. What happened was, the mountain men came west because they couldn't stand, civilization, and what they did was carve the roads out for the, people going to Oregon and California. And it seems like every wave that came west was trying to create a place and escape from more civilized environs. And what they did was just make a really nice nest for civilization to take hold in. And the same people who destroyed the Native Americans, by destroying the Native Americans and destroying that idea, guaranteed their own destruction, because that was part of the idea that they had valued.
In your book, I noticed a lot of literary references and characterizations of lives as narrative. And I couldn't help but to think that you were maybe being somehow self-referential or reflexive about the writing process and the role of storytelling in general. I wonder if that rings true or not.
Less the writing process and more the idea of story and story's influence. And again, it goes back to this idea of a Western myth. You grow up in a story and you don't even, a lot of times you don't even know that it shaped you. But, if you, at some point, if you can look at yourself with some objectivity, you say, geez, this is, I've grown up and been molded by these ideas that people have been packing around for a long time. And that part of what I'm interested in with the Western story and with the idea of story in general is the sort of awareness that that it can lead people in strange directions, directions that maybe aren't intentional and aren't positive. Part of my thinking about the Western myth is that the Western myth is a story that was designed to teach people how to live in a world that didn't last very long. It passed away, but people are still living by the myth. If you live by that mythology right now, you know, right now it's a good way to end up in a penitentiary.
Yes, yes, because, well, it was brutal, and even even the law, or what purported to be the law, a lawman, was essentially making it up as he went along. What was seemed convenient at the time, even if it included killing somebody just because it was easier than hauling them back.
Yeah. Yeah.
This book is told through a narrator, and the voice of that narrator is a strong one. There's a real pacing to the way the narrator tells the story that does get you somewhat in the head of Strahl, the main character. And I was as intrigued, I guess, with who was telling the story. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, about the narrator and why you chose that.
I suppose the narrator was me. I'm very interested in sound. The sound of voices and the and rhythms. I mean, I think if books are going to, you know, one of the aspects that makes a book different than other ways of telling stories is that, you know, the words make a sound in your head. And so I'm very interested in how words sound, how syntaxes are structured and things like that. And I suppose the sound of the words comes from a couple of people that, you know, I've been in my life. One's my dad. And, you know, there's a sort of a truncated syntax that he uses that I think is fairly present in the book. And then another guy is a friend of mine named Lauren Carlin, who's a farmer that out in the Palouse country. And there's a sort of, in the way he talks, there's a sort of animation that I end up enjoying listening to. So the sound of the voice is probably, you know, probably comes from those two sources, as well as, you know, just listening to other people. But, you know, the content of the voice is probably, it has to do with my interest in, I suppose my interest in story, and any of the references that the characters make or that I make as a narrator has to do with, you know, how something is semi-biblical, or how it, I think there's a reference to Teddy Roosevelt and his idea of the American West
and Shakespeare,
things like that. They're just things I've come across as you know, as I was considering. Part of what I have to do when I write, I'm not a very good planner. Plans seem to get in the way, and so I sort of turn myself loose and let stuff come in, and often that means that, you know, things that I'm thinking about will enter the story in different places.
Well, I enjoyed that voice because it did have a very distinctive rhythm and pacing that created a unique world within the story. And there is a lot of grisliness and a lot of grisly descriptions of these murder scenes, and I think it's not for everyone. I know I had a hard time with some of them, yet I plowed through with my eyes closed. And is that something that you felt was, I don't know, driven by the narrative, that you needed to have that in there, or that it is
I always blame my editor, Dan Smetanka, because he kept saying, well, it needs to be more violent. It needs to be more violent. And I think he was right. And I think that the fact that the book is as grisly as it is serves what I was up to pretty well. One of the things about the traditional Western myth is that the violence in it is usually, it's redemptive, or there's some justice in it. And if I was going to call some of those things into question as I was writing, it seemed to me that I had to push the violence beyond that, that I had to push it towards the horrific so that people wouldn't read it as we're in the habit of reading Westerns, which is, oh, well, you know, it's just the rough and tough American West. And so I think pushing the violence to that extent, making it not just, you know, not just awful, but strange, I think allows the book to revisit some of those ideas in the Western myth in a way that's not maybe as reductive or as familiar as I would have otherwise.
Well, Bruce, I just want to quickly mention, it seems like you have another book that you did with your wife, and maybe you just want to talk 1 minute about that.
Yeah, it's a book called Signed, Your Student, and it was actually my wife's idea. She wanted to work on something nonfiction, and I'm a school teacher. So at my school, we went through a pretty horrible thing. One of the students murdered his parents, and they came and arrested him at school. I mean, they had to, and it really shook all of us up. And you know, and my wife, upon seeing how affected we were, wanted to sort of write something that defied some societal assumptions about teachers, which are that they don't care, or they're part-time workers, things like that. And so she thought about contacting people, well-known people, and seeing if they'd tell their stories about their favorite teachers. And she did, and we were shocked and very pleased by their response. There were a lot more people out there excited to honor their favorite teachers than we'd expected.
And what's the name of that book?
It's called Signed, Your Student.
Signed, Your Student. Well, Bruce, thanks so much for spending the time with us today, and I hope we get to meet and visit soon when you're down here in Northern California.
And thank you for having me, Suzanne.
That was a conversation I had with Bruce Hulbert when his first novel, Lonesome Animals, was released. Earlier, I spoke with him about his most recent work, The Hour of Lead. Both books are published by Counterpoint Press. I'm Suzanne Lang. We've had production assistant from Jesse Fankishen, Mark Prell, and Sean Knight. You can listen to us anytime on krcb.org and subscribe to our podcast and listen on iTunes. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.